Today is Friday, August 6th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, UN warns of humanitarian crisis amid Taliban push in Afghanistan.
Taliban have already begun paving their way to Kabul with innocent blood.
Plus, Tigray forces capture famed UN heritage site in Ethiopia.
It's also a holy site for millions of Ethiopian Orthodox Christians in the Amhara region in the country's north.
Also, Australian researchers developed gel to treat Parkinson's disease. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have asked Afghan forces and the Taliban to take care to prevent civilian casualties as fighting for Helmand province rages. This as the Afghan Defense Ministry says U.S. and Afghan airstrikes pummeled Taliban targets in an effort to dislodge the insurgents after they pushed into the provincial capital of Lashkargah. A lawmaker from Helmand says relatives and constituents have told him of bodies in the streets and residents hiding inside their homes too afraid to venture out and collect the dead. The Taliban have waged a fierce push over the past months as U.S. and NATO forces complete their pullout from the war-torn country. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says a, quote, strategic disaster, unquote, is unfolding in Afghanistan.
Taliban have already begun paving their way to Kabul with innocent blood. Al-Qaeda is already rebuilding capabilities to strike at our homeland.
That's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Russia begins mass military exercises with Central Asian allies Tajikistan and Uzbekistan near the Tajik border with Afghanistan this week. The maneuvers come against the backdrop of a U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and rapid territorial gains by its adversaries in the Afghan Taliban. For VOA Moscow, Charles Mays reports.
With the U.S. finalizing its withdrawal from Afghanistan, Russia is taking a two-track approach towards the region. On the one hand, diplomacy, with Russia's foreign ministry holding repeated talks with Taliban representatives in a bid for influence. On the other, a show of force, with Russia's military joining Central Asian allies to confront a possible crisis in the making, say analysts.
It's good that the Americans are out, and it's bad that the Americans are out at the same time. It's an opportunity. At the same time, it's a very grave threat to vital Russian interests.
The Kremlin is openly worried that renewed fighting could destabilize Central Asia, a region traditionally under Moscow's sway. Observers say the military may not be the best defense against the prospect of tens of thousands of refugees streaming across the border and spreading Islamic extremism into a region known for weak autocratic governments, poverty, and corruption.
Attacks against extremists are pointless. They're only there to show that Russia's political power in the region has always been and will always be. But a different and more controversial question is what kind of Taliban might be coming to power.
Russia has long maintained a large base near the Afghan border in Tajikistan, and Moscow says it's ready to come to allies' aid under a collective security agreement if necessary. Officially, Russia still designates the Taliban a terrorist organization. But having fought its own deadly decade-long war in Afghanistan in the 1980s that ended in withdrawal, few think the Kremlin is eager to engage again militarily. But ignoring the Afghan issue is also not an option.
Russia has lots to lose. America can walk away from Afghanistan and forget it as a bad dream. They have that privilege. Russia cannot.
As the American role in Afghanistan comes to a close, some in Moscow say the U.S. has been forced to learn the Soviet lesson of the limits of empire. Yet the fast-changing circumstances on the ground offer few guarantees for what comes next. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
Forces from Ethiopia's Tigray region have taken control of the town of Laibela, whose famed rock-hewn churches are United Nations World Heritage Site, and residents were fleeing, two eyewitnesses told Reuters on Thursday. Soraya Ali of Reuters reports.
Lalibela's famed rock-cut churches are a United Nations World Heritage Site. It's also a holy site for millions of Ethiopian Orthodox Christians in the Amhara region in the country's north. A resident of Lalibela spoke to Reuters by phone and said he saw hundreds of armed men speaking Tigrinya, the language of ethnic Tigrayans, walking through the town on Thursday. He said they were not speaking Amharic, the language of the people of Lalibela, and were wearing different uniforms from those of the federal military. He said forces from the Amhara region, which are allied to Ethiopia's central government, fled on Wednesday night together with local officials. A second man told Reuters by phone he left Lalibela on Thursday morning as Tigrayan forces were arriving. Reuters could not independently verify the eyewitnesses' information. And spokespeople for the Prime Minister, the Ethiopian military, and a government task force on Tigray did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Fighting has spread from Tigray into two neighboring regions, Amhara and Afar, in recent weeks, forcing around 250,000 people to flee. Senior officials from the United Nations and the United States government who visited Ethiopia this week also raised alarm at the widening of the war in Tigray to other parts of northern Ethiopia.
That's Oriya Ali of Reuters. France has stepped up coastal patrols, but migrants are still crossing the perilous channel to Britain. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has more.
At the break of dawn on a beach in northern France, a dozen migrants set off for England on an inflatable dinghy, waving at a man who sees them off. A police patrol had just driven past. France and Britain agreed last month to deploy more police and invest in detection technology to stop illegal migrants crossing the Channel, one of the world's busiest shipping lanes, on overloaded rubber boats. They often struggle to stay afloat, and some drown. But French police can only stem the flow, not stop it. The migrants are numerous, the shore long, and the smugglers adept at evasion. You can see England from France on a clear day, but it's a perilous crossing, says Gendarmerie Captain Ludovic Colli.
The migrants who try to cross over to England are not sailors and aren't really equipped to deal with the North Sea. This channel is extremely busy. There are particularly dangerous currents midway.
France has stopped twice as many attempted crossings in the first half of this year compared to the same period last year, officials said. That's 481 crossings in 2021, while 412 small boats successfully reached British shores. Just a day before, French police had picked up life vests scattered on the beach, together with the remains of a dinghy. The 30 to 35 people on board reached the beach safely, according to a witness. Across the Channel, UK lifeboats rescued several groups of migrants attempting to enter Britain on Wednesday, pulling them ashore at a station to the west of the port of Dover. France already beefed up controls last year, setting up special police units who monitor the shores day and night.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. Dozens of migrants, including children, were brought ashore by United Kingdom Border Force officials on Thursday after being rescued while crossing the English Channel. The group, some carrying few belongings in plastic bags, were picked up by UK authorities while making the dangerous 21-mile journey by boat. The group were tested for COVID-19 before being led off to the rescue boat to a processing centre at the port of Dover. Border Force officials were seen towing empty rubber dinghies to the port, one containing wooden paddles and a young child's shoes. At least 482 migrants crossed the channel by boat on Wednesday, the record daily number, the Home Office said on Thursday. The British government says it wants to make the country less attractive to asylum seekers. Under proposed legislation, those trying to enter illegally will face up to 4 years in prison. Australian researchers say they have developed a new type of gel that could radically transform the treatment of Parkinson's disease and could also help stroke patients. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Imagine a gel that could help a brain heal itself in response to a debilitating disease. Australian scientists hope they've created such a product. The hydrogel is made from natural amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, and has been shown to safely deliver replacement cells into damaged parts of the brain. The gel acts as a vehicle to safely transfer stem cells into the brain. Scientists believe the process can restore damaged tissue and replace lost neurons, which affect patients with Parkinson's disease, a nervous system disorder. About 100,000 Australians are estimated to suffer from the disease, which currently has no cure. Professor David Nisbet is one of the lead researchers from the Australian National University's College of Health and Medicine.
If you imagine a stroke, you've got a whole bunch of dead cells where you're no longer getting blood flow. In terms of Parkinson's disease, you lose a population of neurons. That's what results in the symptoms we're familiar with seeing. Basically, what we're doing is we're introducing replacement cells into the brain to replace those ones so that we can see some repair and regeneration. But they also have the added advantage that we've also shown that they can actually protect some of the existing cells in the surrounding tissue once they're implanted.
The gel is injected as a liquid. In the brain, it reverts to a jelly-like substance and can be administered to specific areas impaired by Parkinson's or a stroke. The stem cells can then be instructed to create replacement neurons. Nisbet says the early results are encouraging.
These all-natural hydrogels can successfully reverse the movement symptoms related to Parkinson's disease in animals, but we're yet to undertake human trials. But, I mean, it's looking really promising.
Scientists say the technology could also be used to eventually treat injured knees or shoulders. The research is a collaboration between the Australian National University and the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health, an Australian Brain Research Centre. It's been published in the journal Advanced Functional Materials. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The owner of Britain's Chelsea football club, Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich, and Russian state-owned oil giants Rosneft have both filed a defamation lawsuit against the author of a book about President Vladimir Putin's rise to power. Activists say the case threatens the freedom of the press, as Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
In her 2020 book, Putin's People, author Catherine Belton wrote that Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich bought the Chelsea Football Club in 2003 on the orders of President Vladimir Putin to extend Russian influence abroad. Abramovich's lawyer told London's High Court that the book contained what he described as lazy inaccuracies, which gave the impression that he was Putin's cashier. Abramovich denies he bought Chelsea on Putin's orders. Author Belton cited two sources for the allegation. One was former Russian government insider Sergei Pugachev, the other anonymous. Defence lawyers told the court that Abramovich's wealth was to a substantial extent on call when requested by President Putin. Press freedom advocates say the courts are being used to silence journalists. Seamus Dooley is the Assistant General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists.
The concern here is that this could lead to, and it's intended indeed, to create a climate of fear which would inhibit investigative journalism and which would inhibit the questioning of those who exercise huge power and wealth and influence. It's about Russia, it's about Russian money, but it's also about Russian influence in the UK.
Russia's state-owned energy giant Rosneft is also suing Belton and her publisher, HarperCollins UK. Rosneft's lawyers argued passages in the book suggested the company had expropriated the assets of Russian oil company Yukos in a rigged auction. Catherine Belton's lawyers told the court the claims were well-sourced and based on years of research and interviews. As Belton is named as a defendant, her personal assets are at risk. Again, Seamus Dooley of the National Union of Journalists.
We have to be very clear that there is a right to one's good name. There is a right to protect your reputation. But when defamation law is used to prevent, as is happening, it seems to me, in this case, the legitimate questioning of powerful individuals, when it is used to inhibit legitimate questioning about matters of public interest, then we have to ask if the law is appropriate.
Financier and human rights campaigner Bill Browder fears a chilling effect on the media.
You're going to have less robust reporting and less controversial books about corruption in Russia and about Putin and about the oligarchs because everyone's going to be afraid of finding themselves in the same situation.
Belton's book was name-checked in a video posted online by the jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, in which he claimed President Putin owned a secret $1 billion mansion on the Black Sea. Putin denies the claim. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is the Voice of America. The militant Hezbollah group says it has fired a barrage of rockets near Israel's position close to the Lebanese border, calling it a retaliation for Israel's airstrikes on southern Lebanon a day earlier. Israel says it is firing back as Prime Minister Naftali Bennett convened a meeting with defense officials. In a statement, Hezbollah said it hit, quote, open fields, unquote, on Friday near Israel's position in the disputed Sheba farm area with, quote, dozens, unquote, of rockets. The Taliban has fatally shot the director of Afghanistan's Government Information Media Center, the latest killing in a series of attacks on journalists and rights activists in recent months. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid told the Associated Press on Friday that the group's fighters killed Dawar Khan Menapal, who ran the government's press operations for the local and foreign media. In a statement Mujahid put out later, he said, Manipal, quote, was killed in a special attack of Mujahideen, unquote, and was, quote, punished to his deeds, unquote. You are listening to International Edition of the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. A World Bank UN refugee agency survey in 8 developing countries finds the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic has worsened conditions for forcibly displaced people, pushing them to extreme measures to survive. The data was collected from 90,000 phone interviews in Bangladesh, Chad, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Iraq, Kenya, Uganda, and Yemen. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An analysis of the data shows forcibly displaced people and the communities hosting them are suffering from the social and economic fallout of the pandemic. However, it finds displaced people are at particular risk from the pandemic, which has increased their vulnerabilities in significant life-threatening ways. The survey highlights the devastating and wide-reaching impacts on the forcibly displaced from government lockdowns. It says they are faced with increased food prices, loss of jobs and income, lack of health care, school closures, and limited freedom of movement. Jeffrey Tanner is senior economist of the World Bank UNHCR Joint Data Center on Forced Displacement. He says families who have been forced to flee their homes due to violence and persecution are at renewed risk of losing their livelihoods.
For example, we see that 9 in 10 refugees in Uganda and 3 in 4 refugees in Chad reported that their total income had decreased since the pandemic. These households have 2 sources of income: what they earn and what they receive through assistance. They experienced employment losses at rates at least as large, if not larger, than hosts.
This loss of income, he says, means displaced people have difficulty paying for food, housing, medical care, and education for their children. Tanner says food insecurity is a huge problem in all countries surveyed.
Forcibly displaced households across Bangladesh, Chad, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Iraq, Kenya, and Uganda reported reducing their food or non-food consumption, or both. In Kenya, for example, adults in half of refugee households are skipping meals so that their children have food to eat. And more than 75% of refugee households decrease the number of meals that they eat every day.
Authors of the survey note forcibly displaced people rarely are represented in national statistics. They say the continued collection of such data will allow humanitarian and development agencies to target their support to vulnerable groups in ways it will do the most good. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Health Organization says shipment of coronavirus vaccine to Africa are picking up while the continent grapples with an upsurge in COVID-19 infections. Again, Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
After a slight dip in cases last week, the third wave of COVID-19 has come roaring back, with infections rising by nearly 19% to more than 278,000 new cases this week. Also this week, the World Health Organization says COVID-19 deaths have reached a record peak of more than 6,400, bringing the total number of coronavirus fatalities on the continent to more than 172,000. Amid the bad news, is the positive prospect of scaled-up vaccine shipments to Africa. Fiona Atuhebwe is new vaccines introduction officer at the WHO Regional Office for Africa. She says there has been a 12-fold increase in vaccine deliveries in the last 2 weeks of July compared with the first half of the month, bringing the total number of doses shipped to Africa so far to 91 million.
We need to be clear, though, in a continent of over 1.3 billion people, this is just a tiny drop in a very large ocean. And in the face of a surging third wave and more contagious variants, vaccine shortages leave Africa dangerously exposed. We have a very long way to go. With less than 2% of Africans fully vaccinated, we cannot get vaccines fast enough into the arms of the people.
Atuhebwe says the vaccines arriving from the United States and European Union are expected to continue, and shipments from Britain will start soon. She says around 110 million doses are expected to be delivered to African countries through the COVAX facility and the African Union by the end of September.
Beyond September, as commitments by COVAX and the African Union and bilateral deals come through, we hope to meet the target of vaccinating 30% of Africans by the end of this year. But we also need up to 250 million more doses to complement the COVAX and African Union doses to meet this goal.
Atuhebwe says it would be a dream to have vaccines manufactured on the continent. She says several countries, notably Senegal, South Africa, Morocco, and Egypt, have the capacity to make it, but not from scratch. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Scientists are building new self-healing materials to protect next-generation spacecraft from harsh elements. Plus, a Russian module misfires in space, and MTV turns 40. VOA's Arash Rabasadi has the week in space.
Our atmosphere, as seen from a SpaceX cargo capsule, sure looks peaceful. But as regular watchers of this segment know, Earth's orbit is littered with hazardous space junk just begging to pierce satellites and components of the International Space Station. So scientists in England started work on new polymers to extend the lifespan of hardware sent to space. Stuart Donovan Holmes is head of defense and space at the National Composites Center in Bristol. He tells AP the pilot program tests materials to endure the hardships of Earth's orbit.
You've got, you know, UV radiation hitting it. You've got all sorts of dust and particles. And when they, you know, react to the surface of the composite, they can have unexpected consequences, which is something you really don't want in that kind of environment. And so part of doing this program is to test this combination of resin and fiber to see what can work in that environment and give us the kind of durability and performance that we're looking for.
To do this, the National Composites Center joined forces with researchers at the University of Bristol, where Professor Ian Hamerton explains the science to the Associated Press.
What we have is a polymer that essentially self-heals. So when we expose it in the low Earth orbit environment, the material reacts with the oxygen, reacts with these radicals, and essentially produces a shell over its surface. So it becomes almost like a protective carapace over the surface of the polymer. So it protects what's underneath.
Hamerton says some materials currently in use are metal alloys dating back to the Cold War. He says the new, lighter, and stronger composites could build solar panels or even structural systems. Scientists will get a chance for real space testing when they launch their composites from Earth next spring. In other news, don't worry. That's what cosmonaut Oleg Novitsky told his Twitter followers this week after Russia's science module misfired and caused the ISS to reportedly pitch 45 degrees. It happened just a few hours after docking, and as more information came in, NASA tweeted that the change was more like 540 degrees. The space agency also confirmed the station is in good shape and operating normally.
10, 9, 8,
Finally this seven, week, MTV, six, that's music five, television, turned 40. To celebrate, the network relaunched its iconic video of an astronaut on the moon holding the MTV flag. The NASA footage was from the 1969 Apollo 11 moon landing. The MTV flag was not. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.